Well, hello again, everybody. This is Mark Roberts, owner of Affinity Asset Management. Thank you for listening in on today's teleconference of the markets and kind of all things coronavirus these days. Note to self, do not use eye drops right before I get into a teleconference and I have to read my bullet points. Things are a little blurrier now than they normally are. Gosh, another really outstanding turnout here for today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to this teleconference. I got to tell you, it's very flattering. We take your trust in us extremely serious. So just thank you so much for taking time out of your day to stay informed. We got a guest speaker with us on here today who's going to chime in when I'm done with my part. We got Karen Kerwin with ProShares who's going to join us here in just a little bit. So today we're going to do something a little bit different than what we've done in the past teleconferences. Based on some of the questions that we're getting from folks, kind of thinking that it might be better that we're going to not do Q&A at the end of today. I'll speak. We'll get Kerwin a chance to speak as well. And then after that, we'll kind of end it for the day. And any questions that you have, we'll just ask you if you don't mind to give us a call or to email us directly. Any of us here in the office that you have our email addresses, send us an email. If it's not to the right person, we'll forward it to the right person for you. So just go ahead and do that if you would, please. So let's start off with performance update. Last week, the market was down slightly, 0.45. That's just a little less than a half of a percent. This week, Monday, market was up 3.85. Tuesday, down 1.59. Since the market high on February the 19th, the market's still negative 19.29. And our bonds, since we got bought into our bonds are negative 0.05. Like, it's at this point now where it's just about ready to be breaking even with the dividends and stuff that it's been accumulating. So it's doing what we want now at this point, and it's been doing that now basically every week since that very first week. So here's some interesting tidbits, just over like the last, I shouldn't say tidbits, just some facts on some numbers, I should say. In the last 30 days, market's been relatively flat for about the last, let's call about 5 weeks now, barely moving up 2% or down 2% in a week, just not really moving a whole lot. The S&P is a positive 1.68% over the last 30 days. The Dow is negative 0.15, so not much difference, you know, just less than 2% difference between the Dow and the S&P. But our bond model is a positive 0.6%. So our bond model is just a little off of the S&P 500, doing better than the Dow, and doesn't have any of the risk that the Dow or the S&P have. It's just all bonds. So again, doing what we want it to be doing. So let's hop into the section on what we call tidbits. So let's talk for a second. Kind of a theme for today is kind of like the psychology of where things are and kind of what's kind of motivated me for this particular topic was some conversations. I got to play in a golf tournament last weekend, and my wrist was not 100%, but it certainly recovered enough that I was able to play in a golf tournament this weekend. And I was playing with a couple of friends that are financial advisors in the Kansas City area, and we just got on the subject of their clients and some stories that they're having. So I want to be clear that some of this is not because of our clients bringing this to our attention. It's really more of stories I'm having from financial advisors and the stress that they're having because their clients are stressed. Their clients' stress is passing it on to them. They're kind of doing nothing. They're kind of paralyzed. And I'm here keeping my mouth shut, not really saying what we're doing or not doing, because if I tell them what we're doing, it's going to imply that they're really not doing anything. So I'm just trying to be a friend and not rub salt on the wound. But it's the psychology behind you have the devil on one shoulder, you've got the angel on the other shoulder. The devil says, be aggressive, be stocks, chase returns. The angel tells you, be smart, be conservative, you know, protect your money. So in a time like this, especially, you know, a big drop, you know, a pretty decent rally from the stimulus package rally, that's what we call it, and then really flat for the last 5 weeks, you know, it's like, oh, I want to get back in the stock market. I'm ready to make some money. I think the market's going to go up. And then other people, oh, I know the shoe's going to drop, and it's, you know, we've got another downturn coming. So the psychology behind this is you have to ask yourself, you know, what kind of person you are. Are you the kind of person that is motivated by if you're sitting in bonds and you're not in stocks and the market goes up and you're missing out on growth opportunity? You know, and think, okay, that's irritating. I'm missing out on growth opportunity because I stayed in bonds too long, let's say. Or the flip side of it is I get out of bonds, I'm ready to get in stocks, and then the market drops. So is the not making money as the market goes up, is that worse? Or is it worse to go into stocks too quick and you lose a bunch of money? And so that's how you have to kind of ask yourself. And your crystal ball is as good as mine, as good as anybody else's. And so we know that nobody has this answer as to what to do and when to do it. but you have to ask yourself what's more important to you. Chasing that return, trying to do things maybe early, or trying to be prudent and a little bit more tactful, and that's what we're trying to do. Is we're looking at the angel side of things, and we'll be ready. We're ready to do things. We're just needing the market to cooperate with us. So just want to kind of talk about that from a psychology standpoint. And the markets right now, guys, are being driven more so now than ever by the media. I think I said something a couple weeks ago that I got from a quote, and it's one of those things I don't really forget about it. The news tail is wagging the stock market dog. In other words, the media is influencing the stock market. It's influencing the behavior of the stock market. So a really good example is just I'll pick on this week. On Monday, market came out, had a really good day on Monday. Market's up 900 points on Monday. And in fact, I reported just a minute ago, Monday was up 3.85%. And that was due to some positive news that came out on Monday morning about a company called Moderna who's saying that they have a vaccine that should be ready by January 2021, so January of next year. But then here comes Tuesday. More information comes out at the end of Monday, comes into Tuesday, and the market drops 390 points on Tuesday, which means the market dropped 1.59%, all because of now skepticism on the facts surrounding the accuracy of what Moderna is putting out there. And I'm being very brief on this. There's lots of news and stuff you can go read on this. But point is, here's some positive news, vaccine, boom, market goes up. Next day, maybe not such accurate information. Probably shouldn't have that information, shouldn't have got leaked out, whatever. Market goes down. So very much being driven by the media these days. And the sad thing is, you know, you guys, you know, all of us as just consumers, we have access to media on our TV all the time. And it seems like the nightly news, the morning news, it's just so much, everything's about the coronavirus, whether it's the virus itself or it's everybody's, how it's being affecting us in society with the coronavirus and the stay-at-home orders. But for us here at Affinity Asset Management, of course, we get all of our data straight from analysts and economists, like Kieran, who's going to be on the phone with us here today, you know, straight from folks like that where we can, you know, have nothing but black and white data, make very smart tactical decisions, try to turn anything that looks like a potential gray area into as black and white as possible. With enough information, with enough research, we can turn that gray area into more black and whites. So we had our weekly investment committee here in our office, which is seven of us in the office that has, I think it's over 135 years of combined experience between the seven of us. And Mike Tsai himself, 34 years in this industry, he was giving us an analogy. He talked about a tsunami analogy, and I thought this was an interesting analogy. So, you know, imagine you're someplace on a beach someplace, and there's an earthquake hundreds of miles away. You never felt it, never heard it. And that earthquake, you know, creates a tsunami in the ocean. And that tsunami builds up water. The waves are getting higher, and you have no idea it's coming. And if you've ever seen movies, and I'm certainly not an expert on tsunamis, but I can say I've seen enough to kind of have at least a general idea. You're on the beach and everything is fine, and here comes a tsunami. It's getting closer and closer and closer. You don't see it. It's just it's on the horizon. You don't hear it. It doesn't make any noise. But the next thing you know, the water on the beach that you're at is being sucked farther out in the ocean. Water level drops, and as soon as the water level drops, boom, here comes this big crashing wave of the tsunami. And that's kind of what we're in right now. You know, we're kind of in this coronavirus tsunami, as we haven't even begun to see all the effects of things to happen yet. So we had a drop real quick to the announcement of the coronavirus and what's happening with coronavirus. We had a nice little rally, and the only thing we've had in this rally is because of the stimulus package, optimism and some enthusiasm surrounding that. So we have some serious concerns that are still coming, and we don't want to make that suit too heavy, but we're not trying to make light of it either, like, hey, let's get back in the market either. So we're, again, being prudent here. Some of our concerns are, you know, surrounding banks. We have a lot of concerns around banks. Interest rates being tight right now, being very, very low, that's a major revenue source for banks, and that's one of the two major things weighing on banks, and that's the big one is a low interest rate environment, and the second one is the economic uncertainty, and those two things go hand in hand with banks. Banks have also been historically a very good proxy for the economy. You start thinking loan growth is going to slow and credit losses will pick up if the economy slows down. The fear factor from the virus is clearly causing an economic strain, and as a result, the odds of recession continue to obviously move higher. The argument is, as everyone says, we are in a recession. We are in a great recession, but technically you can't label that until the end of the second quarter when you've had two negative quarters in a row of GDP, and then you're officially there. But from a number standpoint, there's no way we're going to avoid the term recession. You guys remember 2008, you know, that big disaster that we had in 2008, and a lot of that was centered around banks, loans, and specifically mortgages. And we got lower rates right now. The Fed's come in and lowered rates, which is a great time for people to refinance their debt, specifically their mortgages. But if you're like, you know, 20 to 25 million Americans who've been laid off, it's really hard to get things refinanced if you don't have a job and income. So there's a lot of folks who have the ability to save money by refinancing but can't because the underwriting requirements, you know, is you don't have a job, you can't refinance. So there are obviously some people out there right now that are able to take advantage of it and some people who are not. And banks right now are super concerned about the amount of debt that they have in loans that are outstanding and the payments that are not coming in. So that's what we call like a financial or an economic tsunami to come. And if tsunami is too harsh of a word for me to use, and I don't like using harsh words, I just thought that was an interesting analogy that Mike Sy said this morning. If tsunami is a harsh word, then I want to say backlash. We've got a lot of backlash that's coming economically. And we've been talking about that for weeks and weeks with you guys. Now, I have folks here in my office. I got folks in my office. I got a lot of clients, lots of clients that are landlords, people who own residential property or commercial property that they are renting out to other people. And the number one concern that these landlords have, let's say my employees, they have their jobs, they have stability, they have these things, but part of their lifestyle is the fact that they have payments on these properties that they owe, and they're expecting rent income to come in, and that rent income is extra money. That's part of their lifestyle that allows them to spend money and have that lifestyle. But if the tenants in these houses, the tenants in these buildings and things like this, if they're losing their jobs, if their business is being shut down and they can't see customers, things like this on the commercial side, much less the residential side, then the rent money's not coming in. So you have people out there, for example, who have jobs and have extra money coming in because they own property that they rent out, but they just lost a major revenue source for themselves because their tenants are not making payments. So really, folks that are landlords, they're like a bank. They're like a bank to people who are renting from them, you know, expecting payments to come in. So it's not just the banking industry that is having issues. It's a lot of people out there who own property that are expecting and receiving rent income to come in that is coming in less. I'm hearing constant stories of people telling me how they're trying to negotiate with their tenants to receive less payment from them because they know they lost their money or they lost their income, they lost their job. Income is down in some way. It's like, let me help you by reducing your rent payment for a period of a few months, but we're going to extend your lease on the back end a little bit longer to offset this. But it's, you don't want to lose that tenant, but at the same time, the tenant has no way to pay you. So it's just a ripple effect, and this is the economic ripple that we continue to talk about week by week. Trump, you know, he's been optimistic these days, but it's kind of to be expected, let's say. You know, being the president and all, and keep in mind this is also an election year. He wants to be optimistic on things, and he's certainly, you know, I think you can argue that he's definitely being proactive and very aggressive at what he's trying to do. But I just try to say, let's keep this in mind. You know, this is a first-term president in an election year dealing with a lot of craziness that no other president has necessarily had to deal with this. So he's having to deal with this, but he's also trying to put as positive a spin on things as he possibly can. Because he wants to give hope. He wants to give optimism for the obvious reasons, but he's also wanting to get reelected too. If he was Debbie Downer all the time, or maybe he was in the second term of his presidency and he's talking, let's say, a little bit more realistic and it's less optimistic, that's gonna, you know, it's a different situation and it's definitely a different tone. Moving on, I mentioned my investment committee here in the office. So our investment committee, we meet every week and we have an ongoing topic every single week and collaborating our collective 130-some years of knowledge of different ways we want to get our clients' money back into the stock side of their portfolio. And is there any reason to do things? Is there anything black and white? We can argue there's lots of options. We know what we want to do. We have a plan for it, as we talked about before. Have a plan. Got it mapped out. Got everything researched, back-tested, simulation models, got it approved by compliance. We're ready to go to hit that button and get people into stocks. But the market's got to cooperate. The market's got to give us a window. Last thing we want to do is get bought in now, and then the market takes a dip. And it's like, oh, crud. Here we are trying to be patient, trying to do the right thing, and then we say, oh, let's go ahead and get in now, and then the market drops. So we're just looking for very tactical and strategic moves, obvious dips in the market, and we've been flat for 5 weeks, so we've not had a reason to believe anything other that's going to happen just yet. We've got to wait for more things to come. And it's going to come. We really believe it's going to come. Jobless claims. So I want to kind of talk about this for a second. Jobless claims get announced on Thursday. So I reported before that in March we had 700,000 Americans without jobs in March. In April it jumped 20.5 million. Now these numbers are being projected that they're not accurate and they're lower than what is actually reality because of misfilings and mistakes and that kind of stuff. People who are furloughed thinking that they're going to get their job back, but it's gone on too long and they haven't gotten their job back just yet. The stay-at-home order has kind of been extended, so things have happened. So the number's expected to be a lot higher. And we reported last week that the unemployment numbers has jumped to an official like 14.7, but that's kind of like the unofficial, let's call that, that's like the official number, but the unofficial number is probably closer to maybe 20% unemployment. So as of last week, there's another 2.9 million additional filers for unemployment last week. Now, the Congressional Budget Office projects that GDP is going to drop 38% in the second quarter because 26 Americans remain unemployed. So now this has been talking about 26 million Americans unemployed. This is getting close to what we say is like the, you can call it the real numbers of unemployment, getting close to that 25% range. And if our facts are right on this, and I'm not necessarily the expert on the Great Depression, but from our facts that we have, the Great Depression, unemployment got to as high as 26%. So now what we're looking at is maybe by the end of May, our legit numbers, you know, the numbers reported, and maybe the numbers not necessarily completely reported, are getting close to the 1930s when we had the Great Depression. So that we haven't seen this in 80, 90 years. So this is just a little bit trying times, of course. So we're going to report the new unemployment numbers probably around that first week of June when it comes out for May. So we'll update you on that. So here's some facts on the coronavirus itself. Globally, it's now up to over 5 million cases with 325,000 deaths globally. Here in the U.S., obviously this is where we care about a little bit more, we are up to 1,571,000 cases. That's up from last week that I reported 1,238,000 cases. That's 170,000 increase from last week to this week. That's a 13.7% increase overall. Deaths last week rose 10,106 from last week. That's an increase of 12%. Deaths are now at 83,455, so an increase of 12%. Again, I say this almost every time because when I read these numbers, I just don't understand the media or even the government reporting that these numbers are flattening out, this curve is flattening out. We're still reporting double-digit increases. Even if the increases are slightly decreasing from the previous week, these are still very large numbers, and the double digits every week. And this is people just getting diagnosed, much less, you know, go through the whole process of whether they recover or not. In Kansas, 8,300 cases with 199 deaths. In Missouri, 11,000 cases, 625 deaths. So clearly here in the Midwest, in Missouri and Kansas, we're not hit nearly as hard as other parts of the United States. Corporate bond market turned a dime in April as investors saw the Fed's decision to use corporate bond ETFs as an opportunity to front-run the buying of central banks, said Ben Johnson, the director of passive funds research at Morningstar. So this is something we've been reporting early on, was that part of the original stimulus package was that the government was going to use some of that CARES stimulus package to buy back ETF bonds, which will basically throw money into the bond market, which allows that bond market to heal and continue to be solid and steady. And that's why we put our money into bonds, is because it doesn't have the volatility of stocks, but yet bonds dividends earn a higher interest rate than if we just went to cash and probably got less than 1% in a money market in our accounts. So bonds was definitely a better way to go. Nancy Pelosi came out and she talked about this $3 trillion stimulus package. I think it's now being called the HEROES stimulus package. It did pass the House and it's to go to the Senate, but I don't think we've seen one single report by news, by analysts or economists, anybody. Nobody is thinking that this $3 trillion, let's call it third round of a stimulus package, is going to pass. On top of the 2.2, on top of the 470 million on top of that, so that was round two. Round three, they're talking about $3 trillion on top of that. No one sees that at all going to pass the Senate. If anything passes, it's going to be, you know, negotiated and whittled down. Probably, I think it's being estimated at this point somewhere between $1 and $1.5 trillion. so maybe about half as much as what's already been put out there in the stimulus package. And I want to point out something I said in an email and a teleconference a couple weeks ago. Something I reported on that I thought was a pretty neat piece was, you know, the government, let's say President Trump, Congress, the Federal Reserve, they're doing things. They're really doing a lot of things right now, which I think we can all be thankful for. But it's really kind of a Band-Aid approach. Stimulus packages and what they're trying to do is not the solution to the problem. It's just a very short-term Band-Aid to kind of get us through. And the article that I was reporting on before, I thought it was by a really well-known economist. He goes on to say, the government isn't worried about the cause and effect of that stimulus package. They just want to know that stimulus package is that Band-Aid to help things right now. They'll deal with the problems that stimulus package is going to create later, like inflation or the value of the dollar or the income tax increase that we're all going to have to pay because we have this big old deficit. Now you throw in a stimulus package on top of that. Now we're going to have more stimulus and more stimulus. How do we come up with money for this kind of stuff? So the government isn't really kind of worried about that stuff right now. They'll deal with that later once we can get past all of the stuff that we're in right now. All right, so let's get past some facts. Let's get into some highlights from some analysts and economists. And on Wednesdays, when I have a host, a co-speaker here with me today, a guest speaker, I don't like to put out a lot of information from other major analysts and economists because we have a great one on the phone here with us today. So I'm going to just put out two. And then I want to kind of share that with two other pieces of news that's kind of newsy news, what I like to call the more emotional stuff. So from Dr. David Kelly with J.P. Morgan, last week's numbers on April retail sales, consumer prices, and industrial production confirmed the extraordinary depth of the current recession. We now believe that real GDP could fall by more than 30% annualized in the second quarter following the 4.8% drop in the first quarter. Now, that being said, there are already some tentative signs of recovery. In tracing out the initial pace of that recovery, it is useful to separate businesses and activities into three categories. You got those that can return to normal, those that cannot return to normal, and those that could with a little ingenuity and some help from Washington. So you got to kind of separate those kind of companies and people out into those three categories. So I thought that was a neat little piece. From BlackRock, a key feature of the equity market's rally is its narrowness. The outperformance of U.S. equities so far this year is largely a function of strong gains by a handful of what we call mega cap, super large companies, technology stocks extending a multi-year trend. The five companies with the largest market value in the S&P 500 index account for over 20% of the index's total market capitalization. This is the highest it's been since the tech bubble of 2000. Now, I think we all remember 2000.com bubble. So I've been doing this now for June next month is officially my 24-year anniversary of being a financial advisor and doing what I'm doing here. And I've now gone through this three times in my career where we had major market crashes, major recessions, and I took major actions on my clients' accounts by getting them out of the market and getting back into the market timely. And all three of those times was 2000, 2001, then you have the 2007, 2008 timeframe, and then now the coronavirus 2020. These are times where most advisors out there, most companies are saying, hold on, write it out. And I took action, and I did what, because I keep my money managed the way my clients' money is managed. I have the same stuff. So if I'm going to take action on my money, I want to take action on their money. So I thought this was interesting. Let me read the rest of this here. These are market leaders with businesses in e-commerce and online research. They're poised for better earnings as they have strong long-term growth prospects, robust financial metrics, and business models benefiting from the pandemic-spurred behavioral shifts. In contrast to that, cyclical sectors such as energy, financials, consumer discretionary, and industrials have reported poor earnings and challenging outlooks. So I've kind of said this is a brand new piece that came out, I think, this morning, maybe even last night. But I've said something very similar to several times before, that there are five companies that are in the S&P 500. Now, S&P 500 is made up of the 500 largest companies in the United States, and that's kind of what we call the so-called stock market, and that's our metric that we measure things by. But five of those 500 companies represent over 20% of the entire capitalization of all of the S&P 500. Those five mega companies like Netflix or Google, Facebook, you know, that's three of them. Amazon is fourth, and I'm blanking on what the fifth is, but those five companies are going to do good under any conditions. And so those five are what's driving the market. So what's misleading to us as consumers, us as investors, not just me as the financial advisor, but to all of us who are investors, is when we see the TV kind of market go up, market go down, you know, it's really being driven more by those five stocks more than anything else, because those five stocks out of 500, 1% of that is representing over 20% of the entire S&P 500 index. That's huge. And so the rest of the stocks that are out there, the rest of the S&P 500, all the mid caps, all the small caps, all the other sectors, bonds, internationals, you name it, they're all doing differently than what those five stocks are doing. All right, let me change gears and stay on the same kind of theme here, but I'm going to get away from analysts and economists. Let me talk about like emotional news, or what we call newsy news. American universities, pharmaceutical, and other healthcare firms are being targeted by Chinese and Iranian hackers in the midst of this coronavirus crisis, according to reports. The cyber attacks have been so aggressive that some U.S. officials view them as a similarity to war because they may hurt research into the COVID-19 vaccine, according to the Wall Street Journal. The FBI and Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is the cyber branch of the Department of Homeland Security, issued a statement on Wednesday, today, saying that Beijing is sponsoring widespread cyber attacks intended to steal vaccine research. Okay, there's always going to be some truth in some of this stuff when you kind of read the newsy news stuff, the emotional stuff, but it's drama, and this is the kind of news that we all see on our TV and the kind of news that we see on our internet. From Bloomberg, Chinese doctors are seeing that the coronavirus manifests differently among patients in its new cluster of cases in the northeast region compared to the original outbreak in Wuhan, suggesting that the pathogen may be changing in unknown ways and complicating efforts to stomp it out. So in other words, this virus is mutating. And if it's mutating, it's going to be harder to stomp this thing out, and it's going to create a second or third wave. And the vaccine that we have for the first wave may not work for the second wave, is what this is basically trying to say. Again, is there some truth in that? You'd have to hope so, because it's being reported, but it's definitely dramatic kind of news. All right, so let's kind of wrap up on a few things. On the section of what we call opportunities, we did our community cafe here this morning. Myself and attorney Glenn Stockton spoke on the topic of five critical estate planning documents that we all need to have right now throughout this coronavirus pandemic. We talked about not only just a will, but a living will, a HIPAA release, power of attorney for healthcare, power of attorney for financial care. We had, for our second week of doing this, we're streaming it live on Facebook Live, as well as we are putting out there live on Zoom.com. It's not being recorded. It's not being rehearsed. It's just two professionals talking to each other, sharing stories. He's talking to me from a legal standpoint. I'm talking to him from a financial standpoint. It's just very casual. Two guys having a cup of coffee while we talk. And we had such a great turnout. We had so many people starting to respond and ask us questions that we couldn't even get to it in time, that we took down those questions and we're following up with folks later. So we are going to continue to do what we call the Community Cafe every Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock. The next one is going to be next Wednesday on the 27th. The topic is still being massaged right now on exactly what the topic is going to be, but it is going to be 8 o'clock next Wednesday. I'm continuously right now doing webinars with Glenn Stockton as well, a estate planning attorney, on the subject of estate planning, talking about the pros and cons of wills, the pros and cons of trusts, and then what it's like if you die and you don't have a will or you don't have a trust, you don't have those documents in place. And we're doing those on Tuesdays. The next one is coming up Tuesday, May 26th. That's the day after Memorial Day, 11 o'clock. And if you want information on that, then let us know. Specifically, you can email Stacy on any information that you want to get on the Community Cafe or the webinar that we're doing on estate planning. And Stacy is S-T-A-C-Y at affinityasset.com, affinityasset.com. So you can email her, and she will get you the information so you can be signed up for either the estate planning webinar or the next Community Cafe, and we'll get you that information. A couple more opportunities. Just a reminder, people who are still working on doing their 2019 taxes, if you are a do-it-yourselfer, our broker-dealer with Client One Securities finally came out with software that you can integrate with TurboTax, make life a whole lot easier. Again, Roth conversions, I talk about that all the time, so I just want to mention it, won't go into any more depth. Reminders, moving on to the section of reminders here. Next week's a short week, and now we are going on 5 weeks in a row of a relatively flat market cycle. So we're going to take a break next week, guys. It's a short week. It's Memorial Week. Want to honor our veterans. Want to say thank you to all of our veterans. Thank you to all of our families of veterans for what they've done and have served for us. We're going to take a break next week and skip next Monday's email, which most likely would have been on Tuesday, and we're skipping the Wednesday teleconference. So no email, no teleconference next week. Skip it. We'll start up the next week. So just want to give you a heads up on that. Referrals. Again, we remind everybody, anybody who's given us referral, we're trying to say thank you. We're trying to help our community. We've been getting a lot of referrals. Every time we get 10 referrals, folks that end up, they do business with us. We're doing a random drawing per compliance. That's how we have to make this compliantly legit for us to do this, so that we can hand out and give away Amazon gift cards. And we will do 9 winners out of every 10 that we get. That way it's a random drawing, but can't do all 10 because that wouldn't make it very compliant. So we have high odds. So please keep them coming if you can. Questions. You got questions with anything, financial, whatever, coronavirus, stuff that we can help you with. If you need advice or you want an opinion, please call us. Okay, please call us. Ask for one of your advisors here in the office that you talk to regularly and let us help you with that advice or at least give you some opinions, give you a third-party perspective on something, be a brainstorming session just to chat about the things you want to talk about. If you don't need advice, you don't have a question, but you want to implement something, you know what you want to do, I just say do us a favor just because we typically get inundated after emails and phone calls like this with folks. So just shoot us an email. Anybody that you got an email on, my email, anybody else's email, shoot us an email. If it doesn't come to the right person, we're going to reroute it to the right person. And tell us what you need. Tell us what you want. We'll get it taken care of. We'll call you back to confirm it. We'll email you back to let you know something. Whatever it is, if you need advice, call us. In the opinion, call us. But if you know what you want to do, you have a service request, just shoot us a quick email. We're happy to take care of that. All right, so having said that, I'm done with my side of it. I've been yapping for, looks like, right at about 30 minutes. Let me introduce a friend of Affinity Asset Management. Gotten to get to know him a little bit more here of recent. His name is Kieran Kerwin, a little bit of a tongue twister, with ProShares. His title is Director of Investment Strategies. He's been in the industry 23 years. He basically started 1 year after me. He's been with ProShares for 7 years. He's been helping us at Affinity Asset Management for the last 3 years himself. He's also a speaker at one of our luncheons that we did here in the office last year in 2019. Kerwin, if you're on, do me a favor, hit *7 to unmute yourself. Thank you so much for joining us. We've had a brief visit yesterday to talk about what we do at these teleconferences. I've gave you a copy of my Monday email. You've got a chance to hear me talk here today. We would love, as an audience, for everybody who's called in today, if you wouldn't mind just kind of telling us and sharing some perspectives on things that are pertinent to all of us from your company and ProShares perspective. Would you mind joining us and sharing your thoughts with us?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mark. And I hope you can hear me. It is great to connect with you again in Kansas City. I'm coming to you today from Chicago, and I have to apologize in advance. I'm looking out my home office window here, and I've got two teams of lawn care people servicing my neighbors. So we've got a little bit of background noise, bad time.
Hi, you're fine. We actually don't hear any of that.
Oh, that's great. I was a little worried about that. But again, great to be here with you. Many of you may recall, I think it was back in October or November of last year, myself and my colleague Mike Hurley came out to visit you all in Kansas City and had a really nice time. So we're happy to come back and, as Mark said, give you a little bit of perspective on two topics, so two things that I'm going to hit on today, one of which is the current state of the bond market and a little bit about what the Fed is doing to kind of help move this economy along, and that'll kind of trail nicely from some of the things that Mark said earlier. And then number two, maybe take a little bit of a peek into what this so-called new normal may look like, right? We know that the coronavirus and the impact here has been really a large-scale event, and our behaviors will, in fact, change. The investing landscape will change. Consumer behavior is already changing. And so I'm going to touch on some of the early themes and early developments that we're seeing here at ProShares and give you something to think about as we go forward. So, again, great to be here. And we're going to start a little bit on the subject of bonds. And what I wanted to do just briefly here for a moment is take a little bond 101, if you will, and remind folks why investors own bonds in the first place. So number one, income, right? That's an obvious one, and a little bit tougher in this environment when, for example, the 10-year government bond is yielding less than 1%. I think the last time I checked, it's in around 0.7%. But that's okay. There's other ways to enhance that. The idea here is that income is probably the number one, you know, source of recognition, if you will, for why people own bonds. Number two is diversification, or that ballast in your portfolio. Think about it along the lines of being able to spread your risks, right? So, and I hope I'm not stating the obvious here, but the risks of holding equity securities, for example, or things like real estate. Mark mentioned a lot of folks in your practice there own real estate. The risks of owning commodities, other investable instruments, are very, very different from the risks of holding bonds. So being able to diversify those risks across different asset classes, perhaps at different times, is a very useful feature of bonds. And after all, don't forget that in the case of bankruptcy, and this is probably more important today than it's been so in a while, in the case of bankruptcy, those bondholders will be the first ones to get paid, right? And that, again, is very important. But number three is this idea of risk mitigation. So not to get too jargony or too far into the weeds here, but if you take a long-term perspective of how stocks and bonds behave together in a portfolio, we can measure that by this idea, this notion of correlation, right? The relationship between the movement of stocks and bonds in a portfolio. Typically, over the long term, stocks and bonds tend to be positively correlated. That means when stocks go up, bonds tend to go up. That number, you know, if one were kind of perfect correlation and minus one were perfect negative correlation, for example, one asset class going up, one asset class going down at the same time, that long-term relationship tends to be somewhere in around, call it 0.2. So it is what we would say is a weak relationship, and that's why stocks and bonds often make a good pair in the context of a portfolio. However, and this is the big thing to remember, there are distinct periods in history when stock and bond correlation go negative. And again, that means if equities were to fall, for example, bonds move higher. Three very distinct periods like this in the market history, one of which goes all the way back to 1929 to 1932. And again, we know that time to be the Depression, right? We had a very difficult time, the post-stock market crash. Country went into a major depression. In that period of time, stocks and bonds were negatively correlated. Now, I'm not making a prediction that we are going into that type of environment. I only say that in the context of when things get really stressed in the marketplace, you tend to have these bouts of negative correlation between stocks and bonds. So when equities are very weak and volatile, bonds tend to do well. And really, that was embodied or personified in the early stages of this crisis. Going back to the early stages of this crisis, it wasn't just a flight to quality, but really it was more of a flight to safety. So people weren't just going into high-quality stocks, for example, or investment-grade bonds for safety. They were going into government bonds. They were going into cash. And that is, you know, kind of something that's, again, very important to keep perspective on as we kind of go through this. And the year-to-date returns are telling. Mark gave you a few of those returns kind of since the crisis. I'll go back just a little bit more. If you look at where stocks are, and I'm using the S&P 500 as the gauge there on stocks, even after a really significant rally off the March 23 lows on a year-to-date basis, stocks are still down around 10% on a year-to-date basis, right? REITs, real estate investment trusts, commodities are down over 20%. Flip that equation and look at where bonds are on a year-to-date basis. Bonds are up about 5%. Long-term treasuries are up about 20%. Gold is up around 13%. So again, this is just a little bit of an embodiment of that idea of those negative correlations between stocks and bonds that I spoke about earlier. And this is a good period to think about being with a team that has this kind of dynamic asset allocation wherewithal about them, as Affinity does. And, you know, we're obviously a large ETF provider here at ProShares. We get to see a lot of investment advisors and teams throughout the country and kind of how they behave in their portfolios in moments of crisis. And we see a lot of this idea of quote-unquote staying the course and riding out the storm. And I suppose this is kind of a little bit of a personal insight here. And that approach is fine, right? Generally speaking, stocks go up, right? And generally speaking, after a big drawdown like we saw beginning in mid to late February, if you go out 3, 5, 10 years from now, stocks will probably be higher. That's what history tells us. However, that message of riding out the storm and staying the course, it does have a tendency to send the wrong message. People interpret that as code word for being asleep at the wheel, so to speak. And the truth about asset allocation, and again, we're kind of professional investors. We do this all day long, every day, and we see it done all throughout the country. The truth about asset allocation really is that managing a portfolio is a dynamic activity, and we certainly love to work with good and nimble teams that are able to guide their clients and their portfolios in a very risk-aware and managed approach, and that is certainly something that we applaud Mark and his team for doing. So I just wanted to give you that little bit of perspective. Anyway, moving on, what is the Fed doing to support the economy and the markets? And again, this is something that Mark touched on earlier. I would tell you that if you kind of take a look at the comprehensiveness of what the Fed is doing, it really is impressive. And many people, many experts throughout the world are in fact giving the Fed a lot of kudos in terms of their quick, decisive, and comprehensive action. So most obvious thing that the Fed has really done is they've lowered the rate, the interest rate, right? The Fed funds rate, which is really the key interest rate that they control. They've lowered that to zero. They've already resumed buying very large quantities of Treasury securities and mortgage-backed bonds. Originally, that amount was set at a specific dollar amount, but now the Fed has really moved to this idea of an open-ended agreement, and I think the words that Chairman Powell used more recently is, and I quote, in whatever amount necessary for the markets to function properly. So really the Fed has brought out the bazookas. I will also note, and us here in exchange-traded fund land side of the markets really took note of this, there is a new program this time around that was over and above what the Fed had done back in 2008 and 2009, which is the Fed going into markets and purchasing corporate bonds directly. So They're doing it in two ways. They are going and directly purchasing corporate bond issues as new issues directly from those corporations. But then they're also buying bonds through the ETF vehicle, so through the exchange-traded fund vehicle. And again, that is huge news. It's a huge vote of confidence, not only for the exchange-traded fund as a vehicle, but it's also a huge vote of confidence towards corporate America, right? All the AT&Ts of the world and the Verizons and the IBMs that are out there issuing bonds, the Fed has basically come in and said, we're going to backstop those. We believe in these companies. We are going to buy their bonds, and that gives investors a lot of confidence, and it has done an enormous amount of good in terms of the health, not only of the underlying credit markets, the corporate credit markets, but the overall workings and machinations of the market. So, you know, markets have really, really improved since the Fed has been involved. And, you know, one last thing on this topic that I will close with is this idea of the second stimulus bill. Again, this is something that Mark gave brief mention to. You're going to see a lot of discussion on that in the news. It was passed by the House, but really, for all intents and purposes, it was DOA, as the Senate has some fundamental issues with it. That being said, it is thought of as more and more of an increasing probability that a second stimulus bill will in fact get passed. So you should see, again, markets respond to that over the next couple of months. Okay, so that's the first topic. The second point of interest here for my time with you this afternoon is a little bit of insight into what this quote-unquote new normal may look like. So if you think about, again, COVID-19 as, you know, one of these rare events that is likely to go down as, you know, a monumental kind of period in our lifetimes, probably not all that, different than events like the Great Depression, events like 9/11, where our behavior fundamentally changes, right? And global politics are going to reshape a little bit. Society is going to be a little bit different in terms of how we behave, and the financial markets will be a little bit different in terms of how they perceive risks. So really, this is likely to go down as a monumental kind of watershed type of moment. Of course, it's too soon to tell where this will all end. We are still likely in the very early innings of this. We do not yet have a vaccine, and that, of course, will be a game changer. But we're in the early innings here of what we expect to be a fundamental shift. I'm going to give you a little bit of a taste of what I would call the top five kind of new normal benchmarks to look out for. So kind of like the not quite as ambitious as David Letterman's old top 10, I'm going to give you my top five, and hopefully this will give you something to think about. Number one, this idea that globalization is under threat. If you think about what some of the largest corporations in our country have had difficulty doing, right? They've had difficulty in their supply chains, right? And the idea of their supply chains being disrupted and not being resilient in the situation where the movement of goods and people will be restricted is something that just about every corporation right now is seriously thinking about. It's almost as if we're coming full circle. It wasn't too long ago, and it was certainly in the earlier part of my career, where every corporation, right, was thinking about offshoring and how to get their manufacturing process for as cheap as they could somewhere offshore. Well, right now I can report to you that many corporations are thinking about doing at least in part exactly the opposite, how to get some of those manufacturing operations back here in the States and get those supply chains a little bit more coordinated so they can sustain or withstand disruptions like this. Number two, I'm calling this one technology transformation. The key point here is that data is king, and the race is on right now for companies to get more of it, which will ultimately lead to this idea of an accelerated adoption and use of technologies that will enable us to remotely work, right? Remotely shop, remotely eat. A couple of clicks on your computer will now enable you to do a whole host of activities. Of course, this is underway, this idea of a technology transformation, but we think about technology as a sector. We think about technology being a much bigger part of the market that is likely to continue going further. Number three, this idea that health is the new wealth. And what I mean by that is that the idea of public health is now going to be thought of more along the lines as being representative of a nation's wealth, right? And we have obviously a need here to increase our healthcare capacity and to remotely offer healthcare services. You may have heard, not to kind of name drop stocks here, but you may have heard about a stock that's been very prominent in this whole crisis, which goes by the name of Teladoc, right? The idea of a doctor being able to provide services to you in some capacity virtually. So this whole idea of healthcare and it being more representative of the nation's wealth, pay attention to that theme. Number four, this idea of big government, right? We are all going to be under more surveillance. We are all going to be under more testing. All of this is going to come under the tent of security, of course. There is a price to pay for that, and that price will be our privacy. So our privacy is going to suffer. But big government is likely to be here in more of a volume than it has been over the last couple of decades. And then the last one here I'm going to leave you with is this idea of the new consumer, right? So the new consumer is this idea that purchasing habits are fundamentally changing. That is being led by millennials, right? And these are folks who are coming of age now. They are getting into higher paying jobs. They are becoming a bigger portion of the retail consuming public, and they are demanding convenience. So this market disruption is something that we here at ProShares have done a lot of thinking about recently. I will report to you that the Census Bureau, again, to kind of maybe harken back to some of Mark's points on reporting the facts, we noted that the Census Bureau, so the U.S. Census Bureau, releases quarterly retail sales, and they just released the Q1 of 2020 retail sales report and the retail e-commerce report simultaneously. So I'll give you a couple of the headline numbers to think about. Q1's total retail sales fell 1.3% from Q4 of 2019. That shouldn't be too surprising, right? Because the back half of Q1, specifically March, was already feeling some of the effects of COVID. So for overall retail sales to fall about 1% from the prior quarter, not all that surprising. Take a listen to this. Q1 e-commerce sales, as a contrast, rose 2.4% from Q4 of 2020. And relative to Q1 of 2019, so 1 year prior, retail sales in total increased about 2%, but the e-commerce bucket within that retail sales total portion increased 15%, right? So think about that for a moment. Total retail sales increased 2% year over year. E-commerce sales increased 15% year on year. So that is, in fact, facts that back up this idea that we are, in fact, as a society, experiencing this idea of the new consumer. One afterthought on this report that I think is very interesting and very little appreciated by everybody out on the street, and we think this is critically important here at ProShares. If I were to ask you, how much is e-commerce as a percentage of the total retail sales bucket, right? So how much does Amazon make up of the entire retail sales number here in our country? Most people would say 40%, maybe 50%, maybe 60%, right? It seems like the Amazon trucks are everywhere these days. The truth of the matter is that e-commerce sales accounted for less than 12% of total retail sales. And again, you can find that in the U.S. Census actual report that they just released. So less than 12% of total retail sales right now are coming through the e-commerce channel. The bottom line here is that that runway has a long growth trajectory ahead of itself, and it's something that we've thought about a lot here at ProShares and built a lot of interesting products around. So with that, Mark, that concludes my comments. Again, thank you for having us here participate in your call, and we hope we gave you a few things to think about here that that will relate to your clients and staff. So thanks again.
Kieran, yeah, you, absolutely. No, thank you. Thank you very much for being on here. Hey, I want to make a comment and a question here to follow up with you. The e-commerce up 15%. I mean, I get that. Like a comment from my perspective is our business has, at least from my perspective, my business hasn't slowed down. There's some things that we're not doing out in the community as much as we used to do, and we're finding ways to do things in the community through Zoom.com or a big marker board, you know, electronic video conferencing with large groups of people. We're having just as many client meetings and reviews and stuff as we always had, and it's just we're doing it on the phone. We're doing it through Zoom.com, and we're still able to do all these things, and my business hasn't really been slowed down by that at all. But I got to just say from my perspective, I hope that's not going to be the new norm, because I drastically miss the intimacy, the relationship of seeing people face-to-face, being able to shake a hand, be able to give a hug. And I'm hoping that, you know, technology makes things better, and I'm so thankful I have an amazing team around me that has able to integrate very quickly to technology, to things the way we did things before, to the way that we're doing things today, because of making technology allow us to still run things the way that we do, but still miss that stuff. So I miss the people. I miss seeing I come to work every day wearing jeans, and that's so unusual for me for 24 years. So it's kind of interesting, but so I really appreciate that. A lot of what you said there. I want to ask you a question, something that you said, and I guess I've read enough about this myself, and then you said something. I guess I haven't connected the dots myself on this. You know, the Fed part of the stimulus package is using this to buy back some bonds through ETF bonds. Aren't they also using some of the stimulus package to buy individual bonds as well as ETF bonds? And if so, why are they not buying any mutual fund bonds? Why is it only in the ETF space versus the mutual fund space, even though they're both very similar? Why are they targeting that versus the other? So I just want to see if you have any comments to that.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a good observation, Mark. And just to confirm your thinking there, yes. So the Fed is actively involved in two segments of the corporate bond market. They are, in fact, purchasing directly from corporations new issues, but then they are also going into the so-called secondary market, right, and purchasing bonds, existing bonds in the market through ETFs. In terms of why the ETF wrapper versus mutual funds, I think there's a couple things to remember. And number one, this isn't meant to be a negative thing about mutual funds in any way, right? Mutual funds are very important. But ETFs give you certain advantages, and some of those advantages is not only transparency. So the Fed's going to know exactly what it owns at all times through some of these ETF vehicles. But also the ETF vehicle provides additional levels of liquidity. And more institutions and institutional investors are embracing the advantages of ETFs and as basically a consensus to say, wow, this is a really good vehicle. We know that it's been very effective for equity securities. It is also proven now to be very effective in fixed income land, and the Fed has basically endorsed it by actively purchasing in both investment grade and high yield bonds. So we take that as a huge endorsement.
Wow. Well, thank you for that. I wanted you to confirm that, what I was thinking, and I never thought why they're not doing mutual funds, but I guess that makes sense. And you know, the bulk of our portfolio has way more ETFs than mutual funds, anyways, and that's what we share with clients. It's lower expense ratios, lower internal cost of an ETF compared to a mutual fund, plus the quick tradability of it. And you can trade an ETF and buy and sell it throughout the day and get that price right then, whereas a mutual fund, you buy and sell it, doesn't lock in until 3 o'clock. And in markets like this, you know, the market can move quite a bit throughout the hours of a day till 3 o'clock, you know, central time. So, Kieran, thank you so much. Thank you for ProShares. Thank you for your comments. We so much appreciate the relationship and all that you guys do for my team here at Affinity Asset Management and all of our clients. We depend on you guys, and you guys have been rock stars for us, and I really appreciate you being available for this teleconference. So I will say that and say thank you to everybody for taking time out for listening in on this conference call here today. I want to wish everybody a great Memorial Day weekend. Hope everybody stays safe and stay healthy. Thank you all. Thank you, Kieran.